Good afternoon. I'm not sure if everyone's participating yet. Welcome. My name is Alan Jackson. I'm currently serving as the president of the Chattanooga chapter of the Federalist Society. In coordination with, we were presenting this in coordination with other Tennessee chapters, Nashville, Memphis, and Knoxville. And I hope that this will be the beginning for further collaboration among us. I hope we are joined also by members from other locations. You're welcome, and as well as non-members and non-lawyers. One of the principal purposes of the Federalist Society is to promote discussion of important political and legal topics, both within the legal profession and in the academy and in the broader public. So we are glad to have everyone who's attending, lawyers and non-lawyers alike. I will, the format of this program, we will have three presenters, followed by a Q&A session, time permitting. And this will be moderated by the Honorable Catherine A. Kreitzer of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Tennessee. And we have applied for 1.5 hours of Tennessee General CLE credit. And we are recording participation. And also, if you're a lawyer, if you will type your full name and your Tennessee bar number into the Q&A box, not the chat box, but the Q&A box, we will compile that information and submit it to the TCCLE. And then finally, when it comes time for the Q&A session, if you will, just type your questions, and I guess you can do this at any point, type your questions into the Q&A box, and Judge Kreitzer will pick from them and submit them and pose them to the participants as necessary. So now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Judge Kreitzer. She was sworn in on December 23rd, 2020. As I said, as the United States District Judge for the Eastern District of Tennessee, following her confirmation by the United States Senate. Prior to her confirmation, Judge Kreitzer served as Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy in Washington, D.C., where she provided legal and policy advice to the Assistant Attorney General and Department of Justice leadership. While there, she worked on religious liberty policy issues, among other things, and before serving at the Office of Legal Policy, Judge Kreitzer served as an Assistant United States Attorney. Before entering public service, she was a litigator at Kirkland & Ellis, and she began her legal career as a law clerk to the Honorable Raymond W. Grunder. That's right, yeah, Grunder, on the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. And, you know, I realize I neglected to mention the title and topic of this discussion, which is From Employment Division v. Smith to Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, the Free Exercise Clause in 2021. So with that, I will turn it over to Judge Kreitzer.
Alan, thank you for the kind introduction. Judge Grunder's last name is always a topic of debate, but the fact that you got it right is particularly poignant here, given that Trinity Lutheran came out of the Eighth Circuit, and Judge Grunder wrote a concurrence that ended up being persuasive to the court. So I'm glad that we got it right, and he would be proud. I am glad to be with everyone here today, at least virtually. I hope that very soon we will have the opportunity to see each other in person at events. But for today, the fact that we are working virtually gives us the opportunity to have a fantastic panel of true experts on this issue. It is my honor to introduce our distinguished panel, and I look forward to the robust discussion that we're going to have today of these free exercise issues. First with us, and for me, he's on my bottom left, is Professor Richard W. Garnett. Professor Garnett of Notre Dame Law School teaches and writes about the freedoms of speech, association, and religion, along with constitutional law more generally. He is a leading authority on questions and debates regarding the role of religious believers and beliefs in politics and society. He has published widely on those matters and is the author of dozens of law review articles and book chapters. Professor Garnett is regularly invited to share analysis and commentary in national print and broadcast media, and he contributes to several law-related blogs. He is the founding director of Notre Dame Law School's program on church, state, and society, an interdisciplinary project that focuses on the role of religious institutions, communities, and authorities in the social order. He served on the Notre Dame Task Force on Catholic Education, is a fellow of the university's Institute for Educational Initiatives, and consults regularly with the Alliance for Catholic Education. Professor Garnett clerked for the late Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist during the court's 1996 term, and also for the late Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, Richard S. Arnold. He joined the faculty of Notre Dame Law School in 1999. Also with us is Lori Windham, and for me, Lori is in my top right. Ms. Windham is senior counsel at Beckett, where she represented clients on cutting-edge religious freedom issues since she joined Beckett in 2005. She's represented parties before the Supreme Court, including some fantastic victories, Hosanna Tabor, Hobby Lobby, and Little Sisters of the Poor, just to name a few. She argued the pending Supreme Court case, Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, which I hope she'll share with us her experience today. Lori has won more than a dozen victories in federal appellate courts, including successful defenses of cities and school districts sued for accommodating religion, victories for houses of worship facing discrimination in the land use process, and overturning a multi-million dollar judgment against a major evangelical ministry. She recently won a first-in-the-nation injunction for an adoption agency that was threatened with shutdown for its religious beliefs. Recognized in Washington, D.C. as an expert on religious freedom issues, Lori has testified in congressional oversight hearings before the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee and before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Outside of D.C., Lori is a sought-after speaker on First Amendment law, including appearances at Yale Law School, Harvard Law School, Stanford Law School, Georgetown University Law Center, Central European University, and many others. I hope that we can add a school in Tennessee to that list sometime soon, Lori. We're very glad to have her here with us today. And last but not least is Professor Cody Cooper, who for me is in sort of the bottom middle box. Dr. Cooper received his MA and PhD in government from the University of Texas at Austin. He has been a visiting scholar at Wolfson College, Cambridge University, and a postdoctoral fellow at Princeton University and the University of Missouri. He is currently UC Foundation Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Service at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, where he teaches courses in constitutional law, political theory, and American politics. He is the author of Thomas Hobbes and the Natural Law, and co-author with Justin Dwyer of the forthcoming book, The Classical and Christian Origins of American Politics, Natural Law, Political Theology, and American Founding. Thank you each for being with us here today. Professor Garnett, to get us started, can you set the stage by giving us an overview of the Free Exercise Clause from a conceptual point of view?
Well, I'll do my best. It's great to be with all of you. And Judge, like you said, I wish we were live, but in order to make this feel a bit more like I'm visiting Tennessee, I did order a Nashville hot chicken sandwich from a local place. And when we're done, I'm going to pour myself a glass of George Dickel. So that'll make it feel a little closer, like a real visit. So Judge, like you said, I'm gonna try to set things up. My colleagues, Lori Windham and Professor Cooper will be able to say a lot more than I can about the sort of normative foundations of free exercise. And, in Ms. Windham's case, certainly she's one of the leading religious liberty litigators, alive. So she'll be able to really tell us how these things work. But I thought I would try to set things up by, you know, racing through a few hundred years in about 15 minutes, if that's okay. The first thing I wanted to do, though, is just a I want to throw out a proposition and let people kind of chew on it for a little bit while we're presenting and to think about it. This is how I start my freedom of religion class at Notre Dame Law School. So consider this. It's a pretty easy thing to protect and respect religious freedom if everybody agrees and the government doesn't do very much. The thing is, people don't agree and governments do a lot of things. And that, I don't mean that as a critique of what governments do. It's just a fact that governments do a lot of things and we have disagreements. We have religious pluralism. And therefore, there is going to be, it's inevitable, there's going to be situations where government regulation collides with people's religious commitments and obligations. And so the project of figuring out how to deal with those collisions, the task of figuring out how and when and whether and why to accommodate religious objectors, that task is unavoidable. Again, one could avoid it by getting rid of government or by getting rid of disagreement, but we're not going to do either of those things. I'd urge people to remember also that when we talk about governments doing lots of things, it's not just regulating, passing speed limits, prohibiting bank robberies, and so on. Governments also spend a lot of money. They enter into contracts with a lot of entities, as we'll hear more about with Fulton. They license people to do things they want to do. They accredit institutions to do things that they want to do. They operate schools, prisons, armed forces. They employ millions of people. So there's all sorts of ways in which government activity interacts with religious commitments. And therefore, there's all kinds of opportunities for, as I said before, clashes, tension, and so on. So how are we going to negotiate that? So with that in view, my second big point is just to highlight for people that any legal regime that tries to manage these conflicts is going to have to answer a number of questions. And one way to think about the history of the Supreme Court's efforts in the religious freedom arena is to think about them as attempts to answer the following. I've got six questions. My colleagues might have some more. The first is, what counts as religion? The First Amendment to the United States Constitution protects the free exercise of something. What is that something? It's religion. Our Constitution does not protect, in a generic sense, things people care about. I care a lot about Duke basketball, but that doesn't matter for purposes of the First Amendment. Our Constitution singles out religion for special protection. And so we have to figure out what religion is. And relatedly, our Constitution singles out the exercise of religion for special protection, not just belief. It would be kind of an empty protection if it just said you can believe what you want, because of course we can. The choice to use the term exercise of religion, I think most scholars believe, was a deliberate one. And so we have to figure out what counts as exercise. It's more than just what's in one's head. It's going to include one's religiously motivated actions or one's religiously motivated inactions as well. A third question that has to be answered is whether we should distinguish between laws that target religion for special negative treatment, laws that discriminate against religion, on the one hand, and laws that burden religion unintentionally, on the other. It would be relatively easy, I think, to have a set of constitutional doctrines that said governments may not purposely persecute religion as such. But our Constitution seems to aim at something more than that. It seems, and we've wrestled with this for a while now, but it seems to at least want us to try to identify situations where even well-meaning, otherwise valid general laws might burden people's religion. And what do we do in those circumstances? A fourth question is, should it matter, and should courts be in the business of evaluating, how, for lack of a better word, how big is the burden on religion that the government is imposing? Are courts equipped to distinguish between minor burdens on religion and major ones? Can we distinguish between, for example, a law that makes it slightly more expensive to exercise your religion and a law that prohibits you from practicing your religion altogether? Are courts capable of evaluating that? My fifth question would be whether courts are equipped to evaluate the sincerity of religious claimants' beliefs. It's easy to say, hey, this law burdens my religious exercise. How do we know if the person's telling the truth? Are courts able to inquire into the sort of bona fides of a religious claimant's stated objections to a general law? And then finally, for now, how should courts go about balancing, on the one hand, the free exercise rights of claimants, and on the other hand, the important public interest that the government claims its regulations are designed to serve? This balancing, again, I think is probably inescapable if one's going to have an accommodation of religion regime. Okay, so I gave you one kind of big picture thing that I wanted people to think about when they're before they even wade into the religious exercise issue. Then I set out a bunch of questions that it seems to me as a lawyer, any legal regime is going to have to wrestle with. And Ms. Windham in particular is going to be able to give us some examples of how courts have wrestled with that. But let me just turn now to kind of quick and glib history of how the Supreme Court has dealt with these. I think of it as a story in six acts. The first act is nothing, by which I mean the Supreme Court didn't do much for 100 years when it came to the free exercise of religion. Now, this doesn't mean that we didn't have arguments in the United States about religious freedom, about what was permitted, what was prohibited, and so on. But these arguments tended to take place in arenas other than the federal courts. So we had discussions about, you know, mail delivery on Sundays and the funding of schools that were run by religious orders in what still is called Indian country. But these debates tended to be legislative or in state courts. There were some big fights about Bible reading in the early public schools where, you know, Catholic school children were forced to use the King James Bible against their objection. But again, these weren't, as the saying goes, no one was making a federal case out of it yet. And that changed in 1879 with a big case called Reynolds, which had to do with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, and the practice of plural marriage. And it grew out of what I think is fair to identify as a campaign of persecution by the United States government against the LDS Church. But in that case, the court adopted what I think it's fair to call a pretty narrow understanding of what the Free Exercise Clause protects. In that opinion, I won't go through all the details now, but the nutshell version is that the court seemed to think that the Free Exercise Clause's main concern was with religious belief, and it provided relatively little protection to religiously motivated conduct, especially when that conduct was unpalatable to the majority. So Act Two, I would identify, I'd say in the early to early mid 20th century, the court started to scrutinize more closely some laws that affected religious minorities. These tended to be cases that also involved a free speech dimension. And a lot of these cases involved the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Seventh-day Adventists. But you see the court, and this is consistent with what it was doing in some other individual rights contexts too. You see the court looking a little more closely than the Reynolds court did at regulations which burdened religious minorities. And again, there's an increasing awareness of religious pluralism at the time. There's immigration and so on. The third act is a biggie. Here, the plot is thickening, if you will. In 1963, in the Sherbert case, the Supreme Court adopted the so-called strict scrutiny test, even for neutral laws that burdened religion, even in cases where those burdens were relatively indirect. So the Sherbert case, I think it has to be characterized as a real shift from the Reynolds case involving plural marriage. The court says, look, the Free Exercise Clause guards not only against legislation that targets religion, and not only against legislation that targets religious belief, but it provides protection for religiously motivated conduct, even in situations where the burden in question is being imposed by a generally applicable valid law. And we're going to look at these closely and make sure that the government's really trying to serve a compelling state interest. So that was the rule, again, from 63 for about 30 years, not quite. I think a lot of scholars would say that the rule sounded better than it actually was in practice, that often religious claimants, even under this standard, lost because courts tended to weigh very heavily the government's interests. But we get the high watermark of religious accommodations, at least what I regard as the high watermark, in this 1972 case involving the Amish called Wisconsin versus Yoder. And again, the Supreme Court laid down a marker that seemed to suggest very special solicitude for religiously motivated practice and pretty generous approach toward religious accommodation. But that takes us to Act Four, 1990, the Smith case. Ms. Windham knows far better than I do how this case has played out in practice in the courts. But the nutshell version there is that in an opinion by Justice Scalia, the court said, in what some would characterize as a bit of a about face, that in fact, the Free Exercise Clause doesn't provide special protection for religious objectors who are burdened by generally applicable and neutral laws. It does protect belief, it does guard against discrimination, but if there's a general law, like don't drive more than 55 miles an hour, or in the case of Smith, don't use peyote, the court told us that the remedy that religious objectors have has to happen through the legislature and not through the courts. But the fifth stage is kind of a reaction to Smith. It's the age, it's the act of legislative accommodations and kind of a response to the rule that Smith laid down. So in response to Smith, and it should be remembered that Smith, Justice Scalia invited legislatures to accommodate religion. He wasn't against accommodations. He just said the court's not going to do it. So people took him up on his word, and you had Congress enacting laws like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, so-called RFRA, which we'll hear more about, I'm sure. There was a related statute called RLUIPA, which focused on land use and prisons. A lot of states enacted similar statutes, and a lot of states used their own constitutional law to supplement the floor that Smith laid down to provide more protection for free exercise, even in the case of neutral laws. And that act, in a sense, is still ongoing. If you think about debates in Congress right now about the so-called Equality Act, one of the things that act is designed to do is to limit the use of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in certain categories of cases. But the final act, and this is where I think we are with Fulton, and after this I'll stop, I promise. The final act, I think, is the working out, the kind of fine-tuning of the Smith decision's insistence that the deferential rule adopted in that case is only appropriate when we're talking about laws that really are neutral and generally applicable. If a law is discriminatory, strict judicial scrutiny has to be applied. We saw this in Lacumi, and we saw this more recently, I think, in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case a few years ago. So there's this non-discrimination rule that has survived after Smith, and so we see courts trying to figure out what counts as discrimination. And then relatedly, the Smith rule only applies if a law is truly generally applicable. So what if you have a law that exempts some people for some reasons, but not religious people for religious reasons? It would seem that such a law shouldn't get the benefit of the doubt that Smith held out. And so there was a theory that's been developed, I think, starting with a Court of Appeals decision by then Judge Alito in the Third Circuit, which involved grooming requirements for the police in the city of Newark. And Justice Alito pointed out that, look, if this requirement has exemptions for some people for some reasons, in that case, people who had a medical reason for growing a beard were permitted to, then you have to at least give religious objectors the same special solicitude. And the city of Newark wasn't allowing Muslim police officers to grow beards. So this principle is proving to be a fertile one, if you want, in the sense that there's a lot of laws that have exemptions built into them. And religious claimants, the court seems to be suggesting, are entitled to say, look, if you're exempting some people for some reasons, you have to show special solicitude for our religious objections as well. This is going to be an issue in the Fulton case, as we'll hear, but it's also been front and center in the litigation about the COVID-related restrictions on religious gatherings. So as many people have probably seen, the Supreme Court, not in fully argued cases, but in some of these orders that they've issued in connection with emergency procedures, the court said, look, if these shutdown orders and limits on gatherings are allowing people to go to casinos and concerts and liquor stores and all that, then they have to provide the same care for religious gatherings. You can't treat religious gatherings worse than other gatherings. And that's proving to be, I think, a really interesting development. And it's one that I think the court will be expanding on in the coming years. And I think it's something we'll see the court talking about in the Fulton litigation. And with that, I will stop and turn it over back to you, Judge.
Thank you, Professor Garnett. We appreciate it. You gave us a little bit of a sort of preview of what you think we're going to see from the courts and maybe even the lower court, apart from these sort of COVID-19 restriction cases. Is there anything that you can forecast for us that advocates and folks who are interested in this area of law should start watching?
Well, I think, I mean, again, the COVID one is a big one, but I think a thing I would really want to watch is going to, and Fulton will tell us a lot more about this, as you'll hear, there's going to be increasing clashes or tensions, at least, between expanding ideas of anti-discrimination law on the one hand, and the religious exercise rights of more traditional believers on the other. That's going to come up in the context of accreditation of religious colleges and universities. My own university, for example, has a single-sex dorm arrangement. Is that going to be permissible if it collides with the current administration's understanding of Title IX? So again, that's going forward. I think the thing to be watching is non-discrimination and religious freedom in tension, and particularly in cases where the issue is not direct regulation, it's issues of accreditation, licensing, funding, and contracting.
Thank you, Professor. Lori, we'll turn over to you. We've heard so many amazing references of your work. You really are on the front line, so to speak, of this battle, representing clients across the country in some of these cutting edge cases. What does the legal landscape look like from your perspective?
Well, thank you, Judge Kreiser, and thank you so much for having me here. It's really nice to see you all, and I wish that I was actually able to be in Tennessee with you, much more pleasant than the DC area. So, you know, it's been really interesting, and I really, you know, as always, appreciate hearing from Professor Garnett and kind of getting this framework. And then you think about, you know, what does that mean on the ground when you're litigating these cases? And what we have post-Smith and post-Lukumi is that the cases kind of go on one of two tracks. And one track is if you have federal RFRA or a state RFRA, as Tennessee has, or RLUIPA, religious land use or institutionalized persons, usually prisoner case, then it goes down one track. Then you're looking at what is the substantial burden on religious exercise and can the government justify it? This is how the Hobby Lobby case was decided. This is how the Little Sisters of the Poor case was largely decided. They had administrative law issues as well. But if you don't have that set of protections, then instead we're over here under Smith and Lukumi, and the case becomes entirely about what is neutral, what is generally applicable. And so instead of looking at the impact on the believer and the religious exercise that's being restricted, instead you're looking at the policy that the government is trying to enforce and whether they're enforcing it across the board, what kinds of exceptions they make, even where they're failing to regulate. Are you regulating this religious thing and then failing to regulate something that has similar impacts, which was one of the issues in Lukumi. And so when you're doing that and you're trying to figure out, okay, how strong is my case? what do I need to prove? Unfortunately, the first question you have to ask is, which circuit am I in? Because the lower courts have really split over exactly how it is you you analyze these cases and you define what is neutral, what is generally applicable. And so to take a couple of cases, and these questions don't always arise with hot button social issues, but I think these two cases kind of illustrate where the circuits are at. In the Ninth Circuit, you had the Stormans case, and that had to do with a regulation that required pharmacies and pharmacists to stock and dispense the morning after pill and the week after pill. And there were some, for religious reasons, who were unable to do that. But the state had cracked down on this, and there was significant evidence that this rule was prompted by particular religious objectors. There was evidence that no woman had been unable to obtain it and to obtain these medications if she wished to do so. And there was evidence that there were a lot of things that weren't regulated. And so a pharmacy might not store certain medication because it required special refrigeration and they weren't equipped for that. So they didn't carry that. Or they might specialize in particular kinds of medication and not carry others. And so there were a lot of medications you didn't have to store, you didn't have to dispense. And yet the Ninth Circuit said there, well, the law is neutral and generally applicable. It applies to everything that's not accepted, which I can't think of a single law that doesn't apply to everything that is not accepted. And that other, that the plaintiffs there couldn't point to someone else who had done the same thing for a different motivation and not been punished. And that was how the Ninth Circuit defined neutral and generally applicable. I think that's really in tension with what the Supreme Court said in Smith and Lukumi, but that is the standard that was applied. It drew a three-justice dissent from denial of cert that was pretty sharp. And then, by contrast, you're sitting in the Sixth Circuit. And so if you look at the Sixth Circuit, it's adopted a much broader view of how you look at what's neutral and generally applicable. In the Ward case, this was a case of a counseling student who was going to be kicked out of the program in her public university because she was not able to counsel certain LGBTQ clients with regard to personal relationships. She would provide a referral to someone else in that case. And the university was going to kick her out of the counseling program. She couldn't do that. But it turned out that they allowed referrals in a lot of other circumstances for sensitive questions like end-of-life issues and counseling, even for clients who couldn't pay. There are a lot of places where it was okay to make the referral, but just not for Ms. Ward. And so the Sixth Circuit said, no, that's not a neutral or generally applicable policy. In fact, you're making individualized exemptions. This has to pass strict scrutiny. And in Fulton, the Third Circuit adopted something that was pretty similar to the Ninth Circuit in its side of the split, whereas other circuits, including the 10th, the 11th, 7th, and 8th, and the 2nd, have looked more broadly at why do we have this rule? Is it really neutral? And also, who else is being exempted? You don't have to prove that someone else did the exact same thing that you did and didn't get in trouble. They look more broadly at other comparable activities. And so that is where the law has been up until the last few months. And, you know, the question that I hope the Supreme Court is going to be resolving in Fulton.
You'd think that I'd be better at these computer things after a year of the pandemic, but we're not yet. Laura, you alluded to the recent Supreme Court activity. Since about 2017, we've seen quite a lot from the court in the religious liberty sphere. Can you give us an overview of what we've seen in that relatively short period of time?
Certainly. The court has been really active on free exercise issues in the last few years after a while of not saying a great deal about it. We've, of course, had the Masterpiece case where the court looked at the expressions of animus and non-neutrality from decision makers in that process. And we've had a couple of really big shifts in the law with the Trinity Lutheran case and the Espinosa case. And those are particularly interesting, as Professor Garnett talked about, because they involve funding. And Trinity Lutheran was a government funding and grant making case where the Trinity Lutheran Church had applied for a grant, and it was a program that Missouri did for scrap tires. You could get funds from recycled scrap tires to resurface your playground. And Trinity Lutheran wanted to resurface its playground, applied for a grant, was denied solely because it was a religious organization, because it was a church. Missouri's Blaine Amendment prevented the state from being able to provide those funds to a church. And so this case went to the Eighth Circuit. The church lost at the Eighth Circuit, to the surprise of many people who work in this area, including me, and then went up to the Supreme Court, where the court said that, no, this is not a neutral law. You're singling out religion and saying that just because you are religious, you're going to be treated differently in the government grant-making process. That's impermissible under the Free Exercise Clause. And so this was a big change, and it was really remarkable, especially for those who had been litigating over state Blaine amendments and restrictions on school and other kinds of funding. So then the court decided the Espinoza case, which did come up in the school funding context. There it wasn't a direct grant, it was a tax credit program. And the Montana Supreme Court had actually invalidated the entire program for everybody, because some of the tax credits would flow to ultimately benefit religious schools. And the state, under its Blaine Amendment, said, no, we can't do that. It would have been permissible under the Federal Establishment Clause. It was not permissible under the Blaine Amendment. And once again, the Supreme Court overruled that decision and said, no, you cannot cut off this program. You cannot take these actions solely to exclude religious schools from this program because they are religious. That's not a neutral policy. And so this has been a big change. It's often talked about in the context of school choice initiatives and government funding, but I think it's really important to think about what it's going to mean going forward as we look at other kinds of cases and try and parse out what is a neutral law, what is a generally applicable law, what counts.
Lauren, in addition to the Supreme Court's recent opinions that we've already talked about, we've seen some very powerful orders, as Professor Garnett referenced, in the COVID-19 pandemic context. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what it might signal for advocates in this space?
Certainly. I mean, it's been, you know, it's cliche by now to say it was a strange year, but it really is, you know, from a free exercise perspective, who here would have thought 2 years ago that state and local governments would have been passing orders prohibiting people from gathering for religious worship or religious ceremonies, or restricting how those are carried out, and this would be widely accepted? If somebody had told me that in 2018, I would have laughed at them. And yet here we are. And that's not to say that those orders were all wrong by any means. You know, speaking personally from my own religious community, they've been even more conservative in their approach than what the state has mandated, and have been very cautious in that approach. So have many others as well. But we find ourselves in this very strange moment where we're encountering questions that really haven't been encountered before, at least in many, many years. And so just about a year ago, the first couple of these cases go up to the Supreme Court. And this has been happening through emergency orders, you know, again, because of the accelerated timeline. That's how these things happen. You're not looking at, you know, a 3 to 5 year timeline for a case to get to the Supreme Court, which would be pretty typical. You're looking at a few months. And the Supreme Court upheld restrictions on worship. Even though in the Calvary Chapel case in Nevada, you had casinos that were open, churches that were restricted much more stringently than casinos. And yet even so, the Supreme Court upheld that restriction. And so a lot of people were saying, well, okay, you know, worship capacity limits are here to stay, at least as long as the pandemic is, that's going to be the rule. But, you know, things went on. Months went on. People were still unable to meet for worship as they had previously. Case counts went down, and these cases came up to the Supreme Court again. And my colleagues and I at Beckett represented Agudath Israel in a case that went up to the Supreme Court in November, along with the Diocese of Brooklyn. And what had happened there was pretty remarkable. Governor Cuomo had created, gone and drawn on the map some orange and red zones that really really tracked Orthodox Jewish communities in Brooklyn. And in fact, in one press conference, had even used the word targeting and had especially stringent restrictions on there. And this caused a great deal of concern and consternation from those in the Orthodox Jewish community, also prohibited them from having more than 10 people in a synagogue in a red zone. Even a synagogue that seated 400 people could have only 10. In an orange zone, you could only have 25, and swept in churches and other houses of worship as well. And so this went up to the Supreme Court, and Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, the court issued an order and said that New York had gone too far. There were a lot of things that were allowed, even within the orange and red zones, that had similar risks to churches, and yet were not restricted in similar risks to churches and synagogues, and yet were not restricted in the same way. So you had manufacturing facilities, transportation facilities, even things like campgrounds and garages and acupuncture clinics that were allowed to operate with more freedom than houses of worship. And then in the orange zones, even non-essential businesses were allowed to have many more people in their businesses and in their spaces than houses of worship, which were capped at 25 people, no matter the size of the space. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Even aside, it did note some of the statements indicating targeting of a particular religious community, but said, even aside from that, you can't treat religious organizations so unevenly unless you can pass strict scrutiny. And that went back down to the lower courts. New York did not want to try and pass strict scrutiny and actually asked the lower court to go ahead and enter an injunction, which it did, protecting the houses of worship. Then we saw the Supreme Court again in several orders. And I should say, we've been tracking this at Beckett. I wish I had the graphic to share with you. We actually have a time lapse of the map over time and how the restrictions grow and then how they all change. After the Supreme Court's order in November, jurisdictions started loosening up on houses of worship, and New York, California, DC, and a couple of others were real outliers in how stringently they were restricting houses of worship. And California in particular, continued to have restrictions even after the Diocese of Brooklyn decision. It went up to the Supreme Court a couple more times in the South Bay decision and then in Tandon v. Newsom. And the Supreme Court issued orders enjoining California's restrictions, at least with regard to those houses of worship. And I just wanted to briefly read this statement from the Tandon decision because I think it's really remarkable. And gives us a lot more clarity about where the Supreme Court is going and how it's thinking about these issues going forward. And there the court said, government regulations are not neutral and generally applicable and therefore trigger strict scrutiny under the Free Exercise Clause whenever they treat any comparable secular activity more favorably than religious exercise. It is no answer that a state treats some comparable secular businesses or other activities as poorly or even less favorably than the religious exercise at issue. And I think that's really a remarkable statement and shows us that going forward, not just in the COVID context, but in other contexts too, what we need to look at is, are you treating some other secular entities better than you're treating religious exercise? If so, the government is going to have to prove up its case to show why it needs to do that.
Laurie, that's a perfect segue to Fulton, the case that you argued this term before the court. We are still awaiting an opinion from the Supreme Court, but can you tell us about your experience with that case?
Certainly. So Fulton started back in 2018. We represent Sharon L. Fulton and Tony Sims Bush. They are foster moms in Philadelphia in their respective homes. They fostered more than 45 children, adopted a number of them, and both are Catholic and partner with Catholic Social Services of Philadelphia to do that work. Back in March of 2018, the city of Philadelphia did two things in 1 week. First, it put out an urgent call for 300 more foster families to join the system because they had a need for more homes. Second, it shut down all foster care placements to Catholic Social Services and all the families who worked with it, including Sharon L. and Tony and others. And the reason they did that was because they learned through a newspaper article that Catholic Social Services of Philadelphia could not provide a written home study certification for a same-sex couple if a couple were to approach them and ask for that. No same-sex couple had complained. In fact, none had even approached Catholic Social Services asking for that kind of foster care certification. But if one had, they would have been referred to one of 29 other agencies who could provide that service for them. And the city government said, no, we cannot have this. The city council passed a resolution saying this was discrimination under the guise of religious freedom. The head of Family Services instituted an investigation against religious agencies to find out if anyone else had similar policies. And they immediately stopped all child placements or all foster placements with Catholic Social Services and its families. And that has been the case now for 3 years. The district court would not grant a preliminary injunction in that case. It went up to the Third Circuit, which upheld that decision. And then the Supreme Court granted cert. When the court issued the cert grant, it actually took up three questions. And one was this question we've been talking about: what is neutral? What is generally applicable? How do you deal with the circuit split? Two was a speech question, which Professor Cooper has written about, because there were some really interesting compelled speech issues in this case. And third was Employment Division v. Smith. Should the court revisit that decision and its free exercise framework? Four justices had signaled an interest in doing that in a previous concurring opinion, and the court agreed to look and consider that question in Fulton. And so this case suddenly had an even bigger spotlight on it than it had before. Argued the case on the morning after the election, was joking. I was one of about five people, I think, who was awake in DC that morning. And of course, court heard it by phone due to the COVID restrictions. And it's interesting doing the telephone arguments, gives you an opportunity to hear from every single member of the court, get some insight into what they're thinking about the case, which is a really interesting way to do it. You even hear and get questions from Justice Thomas, which I appreciated. The court really had some of the justices had some really strong questions for Philadelphia, why it chose this particular route, why it chose just completely cutting Catholic Social Services off, really did wrestle with these questions: what's neutral, what's generally applicable, how do we resolve that? Philadelphia has tried to argue this case as a contract case and say, well, this is because we have a contract, therefore we have more leeway in how we do that. That's why I think it's really interesting when you look at the history of free exercise, when you look at Trinity Lutheran, when you look at even Sherbert v. Verner, the Supreme Court has put the government to its proofs and required it to accommodate religious exercise, even when you are talking about government contracts and benefits. And I would add here that the city of Philadelphia has total control over who can provide services for foster children because it decides where the foster children go. So this is a bit different, I think, than your traditional contract case. But there's a lot of different angles in this case. It's, a really interesting one. It's been interesting to litigate. And of course, we are anxiously awaiting decisions sometime between now and the end of June.
Thank you, Lori. I hope we have a chance to talk with our participants a little bit later and allow them to ask you some of the questions that I'm sure they have about this case and your experience. Professor Cooper, last but not least, we're moving to you. You may be the wisest amongst all of us. You're the only one here who isn't trained as a lawyer, but you have written on these free exercise issues from an academic perspective. What can we learn about free exercise from our nation's history and founders?
Well, let me just first say thank you, Judge, and thanks to the Federalist Society. And it's a real honor to be on this panel. Fellow panelists are very distinguished. I've heard it said once before, you may recall this saying, the first shall be last, the last shall be first. I think this panel's evidence that that's not necessarily applicable in every situation, but I'm glad to be here. So the founders' understanding of religious freedom, which as we've just heard, it is raised in Fulton, in as much as the way that Smith was argued and decided, some argue that there wasn't much engagement with the founders thought about this. About 30 years ago, and it was around the time of Smith's decision, a scholarly debate broke out that continues today over this question about how the founders thought about religious freedom. And you can think about it as sort of two major camps. On the one hand, the freedom protective or exemption view, and on the other hand, a secular regulation or non-exemption view. So one scholar, Michael McConnell, was the principal defender of the freedom protective view of religious freedom that would have required exemptions from generally applicable laws. And his probably principal critic and interlocutor, Philip Hamburger, defended a non-exemption interpretation of free exercise that touched off this debate that continues till today. I think the debate's interesting for many reasons, not least of which is that you can find evidence, I think, to support both views to some extent in the founding era. And indeed, sometimes you can even find evidence within the same passage or work from one, the same author, that can be leveraged in support of each view. Take, for example, George Washington's letter to the Quakers. A defender of the freedom protective view would point to language in that letter where Washington says, "Conscientious scruples of all men should be treated with great delicacy and tenderness. And it is my wish and desire that the laws may always be as extensively accommodated to them," end quote. But in that same letter, so that would be leveraged in favor of the freedom protective view, but in that same letter, Washington also seems to condition religious freedom on performing, quote, one's social duties faithfully. And he gently chides the Quakers for, quote, declining to share with others the burden of common defense. And so that would tend to, the non-exemptionists would argue, support the idea that you have to think about religious freedom as in light of obedience to duties set forth by the law. So the debate between McConnell and Hamburger is interesting. It's actually, I think there actually is a Federalist Society event video you can go out there and check out if you're interested more about it. I'll just give you a really brief zoom in on one part of it that I think is interesting. McConnell argues the key to really understanding the founders' approach is looking at state constitutional language. So nine of the states in the founding era had these provisos that religious freedom was to be protected, provided the actions were peaceable or did not disturb the peace and safety of the state. These, McConnell believes, identify a narrow subcategory of general laws regulating peaceable conduct. So for McConnell, free exercise guarantees exemptions in spite of generally applicable laws governing peaceable conduct. But Hamburger, on the other hand, read this evidence differently. He, in making the case for the non-exemption view, he said that the class of actions that would count as non-peaceful was actually much broader than McConnell led on. He maintained that for the founders, and he drew from the common law and other evidence for this, every breach of the law is against the peace. So the secular regulation or non-exemption view would be that you're guaranteed free exercise provided you obey these generally applicable laws. In other words, you're acting peacefully in that sense. So my take on this, a lot of folks have done a lot of really interesting work, and if I have any insight here, it's definitely, you know, shoulders of giants and all of that. But I think that maybe there's some light that can be shed on it if we think about it in terms of the founders' natural law theory. And so what was that? Well, this also is very contested in the scholarship of what the founders really thought about natural law. In my view, the founders did adopt a sort of classical natural law theory of morality. They believed in an objective moral order that was divinely pedigreed, knowable by unaided reason, and through conscience informed human beings of their duties and rights and goods that they're constitutive of flourishing. And it would take a lot of evidence to really prove this to you. I'll just give you a couple of quotes from some, I think, leading founders. James Wilson said it like this: "Order, proportion, and fitness pervade the universe. Around us we see, within us we feel, above us we admire a rule from which a deviation cannot or should not or will not be made." Or in Alexander Hamilton's words, quote, "The deity, from the relations we stand in to himself and to each other, has constituted an eternal and immutable law, which is, indispensably, obligatory upon all mankind, prior to any human institution whatever." And various other founders, such as James Otis and others, explained that the precepts that make up the content of natural law are manifest in the consciences of persons who have functioning powers of reason, and in part consisted in a set of naturally known duties: the duty to self-preservation, therefore the right to preserve oneself, the duty of maintenance and care of one's household and family, therefore the right to acquire and possess property, the reciprocal rights and duties between spouses, parents, and children, duties connected to social peace related to not injuring or offending one's fellows, and indeed, spiritual duties to pursue truth and to honor God. Now, some scholars would reject this kind of view that I'm suggesting is the founder's view. They would say, actually, if you really want to understand the founding political thought, you need to think about, they would see it as self-interested contractors who, for selfish, self-seeking reasons, decide to create law and obligation, sort of deriving obligation from natural rights. And natural rights is untethered by any objective moral principle. I think that that narrative has a story exactly backwards. I think that the founders believe natural rights derive from natural law, the laws of nature and nature's God, in the words of the Declaration of Independence. And therefore, a free exercise of religion was also grounded in natural duties, namely the natural duty connected to the good of religion. James Madison wrote that religion is antecedent to the civil law. It is, quote, "the duty we owe to our Creator in the manner of discharging it." For Madison, it was because of this prior natural duty that the rights of conscience had to be respected by civil authority. This duty and right transcended the civil sphere and grounded the fundamental equality of all persons to seek out the truth about God, the good of religion, worship, etc., free from coercion of the state. So the upshot of this is that the founding understanding of free exercise of religion was rooted in the precepts of natural law. And the founders understood positive law to be grounded in the natural moral law, and that includes duties to God. And so the North Carolina State Ratifying Convention, echoing Madison's language in the Moral Remonstrance, says that religion is the manner of discharging the natural duty. They speak to religion as a natural duty that's to be discharged by, quote, reason and conviction rather than force and violence. The language of reason and conviction is important, I think. It suggests that there's both an objective and a subjective component that do have some tension with each other. Subjectively, religion has to be an individual's own conscientious conviction, but objectively, reasonable pursuits of religion will abide by the precepts of natural law. One way founding constitutional language suggested this was in some of the state constitutions. They indicated that religious freedom would not provide a shield for licentious behavior, as New York's Constitution, 1777, South Carolina, 1790. Licentiousness, what was that? Well, it referred for the founders to disordered acts of will, which flowed from unruly passions, as opposed to what they sometimes called sober reason. And reason is what discovers the precepts of natural law, that is sometimes referred to as the dictates of reason. So licentiousness referred to in the law and other places in founding literature to a range of behaviors, such as rioting, theft, slander and libel, trespasses of frontiersmen on people of other nations, movements to break up states and form new ones, sedition, resistance to paying taxes on whiskey, right? You want to drink that George Dickel, you're going to have to pay a little tax. Name just some. And Blackstone included sexual activity outside of man-woman wedlock as a form of licentiousness as well. So with regard to the latter, the founders saw man-woman marriage as of a piece with their natural law philosophy. In John Witherspoon's words, marriage is, quote, part of the natural law, and, quote, holds a place of first importance in the social compact. Hence, it was commonplace for states to sanction behaviors destructive of marriage, including behaviors like adultery. So given that they grounded religious freedom in the duties that arose from natural law, the founders rejected out of hand any notion that religious freedom could become a shield for exemption from laws regulating licentious conduct or laws promoting virtue. It seems to me that if you read the founders that way, the natural right to religious freedom would effectively become twisted in subversion of the very precepts of natural law it was grounded upon. Now, this does not mean the founders were necessarily averse to any religious accommodations or exemptions. And I think there is a reasonable debate to be had about whether the locus of this is the judiciary or the legislature. We can talk more about that. But those exemptions were granted for behaviors that did not contravene fundamental moral norms, or they were granted in a way that avoided subversion of the moral norm. So take, I mentioned before, Washington's example of the burden of common defense. Washington would have thought that it is a presumptive duty of citizens to contribute to the common defense, and including in military service. And that came in tension with the Quakers' conscientious objection to military service, which they saw as a natural right. When state legislatures faced the reality that some conscientious objectors would rather die than fight, they sometimes accommodated them with an exemption. But they accommodated them in a way that still required the exempted to shoulder a share of the burden of common defense through alternative means. So in New Hampshire's constitution, it said, no person who is conscientiously scrupulous about the lawfulness of bearing arms shall be compelled thereto, provided he will pay an equivalent. So what conclusions should we draw from all this? It seems to me that the non-exemption view is correct insofar as it emphasizes that licentious conduct under the color of religious motivation cannot provide a standard of justice. On the other hand, it seems to me the evidence also indicates that the exemption view is closer to the mark in pointing out that the scope of religious freedom is determined by prior religious duty. Okay, so what does that mean? It's frankly not easy to define precisely the contours of what this means. Madison's language, remember, has both subjective and objective components. And across the founders' writings, you see this a lot in Washington, you see this a lot in others, the good of religion is intentionally underspecified because the founders believed in a principle of religious pluralism. But maybe we could say the following is included in the founders' understanding of religious freedom. First, it includes a freedom of conscience and the right to exercise, specifically in the sense of the right to exercise one's individual convictions in the act of worship, in the action of worship. Second, the right to act on religious reasons when carrying out one's natural moral obligations. And this can ground or color the exercise of one's other civil liberties, such as speaking or publishing freely about the religious reasons for one's political convictions, for example, and potentially other civil liberties. And third, the right to put into action one's individual convictions about one's religious duties. Now, this right, it seems to me, may trump civil law in matters on which natural law is indifferent, which in the tradition is sometimes referred to as the realm of determinatio and mala prohibita, the idea that there's a sphere of human action that is open to human prudence in how it is regulated. So, what would be the upshot for Fulton for all of this, just maybe briefly? I don't think I've said enough to justify this necessarily, this conclusion. I've written about this in the Federal Society Review if you want to check it out. But it seems to me, or one conclusion I draw from some of this stuff is that it seems to me anyway, on an originalist view, a key question in the Fulton case is super difficult to answer. The free exercise of religion for the founders included the freedom to believe, as indeed it was a commonplace to believe, that marriage is a man-woman union, that it is optimal for children to be raised by a mother and a father, that love of God and neighbor requires one to provide needy children with homes informed by these ideals, and that civil authorities act unjustly when they prohibit individuals and institutions from acting on those beliefs. So, with that, I'll pause there and continue the discussion.
With that, we are going to open up the Q&A portion of our conversation. As Jenny has indicated in the group chat, please use the question and answer box to type in your questions rather than the group chat, two different functions, and this will allow me to moderate our conversation. But to get us started, Professor Garnett, I'd like to hear your reaction from an academic perspective to what Professor Cooper just told us about, specifically the McConnell versus Hamburger debate.
Yeah, thank you. Just by way of a friendly footnote to what Professor Cooper was setting out, I think Professor Cooper mentioned this in his remarks, it's really important, at least for we lawyers, to remember that in American constitutional law, that the debate really hasn't been between an exemption view or a non-exemption view, in the sense that very few people, put aside some law professors, but very few judges have ever adopted the view that exemptions are impermissible. And even in the Smith case, Justice Scalia, again, goes out of his way to say that exemptions are appropriate. It's the question in the Supreme Court has been about who decides. Should exemptions be created by judges in the context of litigation about generally applicable laws, or should exemptions be determined by the legislature when it creates laws, or perhaps when it enacts a super statute like RFRA, or perhaps should they be determined by executive agencies and executive actors? It's important to remember, and this is an important debate, and I think Professor Cooper is exactly right that in terms of the original meaning, we can find evidence for both positions. But in the American tradition and in American law practice and doctrine, it's almost universally recognized that exemptions for religious objectors are appropriate sometimes. We can't exempt all conscientious objectors. You can't run a legal system that way. But we've always had in our law a willingness to acknowledge that religious commitments are important, that religious objections should be taken seriously, and that there are often very strong moral and policy reasons for accommodating objectors. I can only think of two justices who've even suggested a contrary view. So it's just worth remembering that although there is this theoretical disagreement, in the law, there's a really strong American tradition of respecting religious objectors.
Thank you, for Professor Garnett. And I think that leads nicely into the first question that we've got from our participants. And Lori, I'm going to direct this question to you. I apologize, but we're going to ask you to grade your own work on Fulton. The question as I read it is, do you believe the Fulton case will give the Supreme Court an opportunity to reverse or truly reconsider employment division versus Smith? You may be a bit invested in this, but what do you think?
I certainly hope that's the case. I think it's very obvious that the Smith decision has created a lot of confusion. You know, speaking from the practical litigator's perspective, it's created a lot of confusion about exactly what the rule is and how it applies. And I think clarifying that standard, as the court has already been taking steps to do, is really important and would be a huge benefit for both religious liberty and for the courts as they're figuring out, you know, how do we apply these rules. But I don't think that does answer the ultimate question, which is, what does the free exercise clause do? How do we understand it? And I really appreciate Professor Garnett and Professor Cooper talking about some of these bigger questions of where does it come from and how do we conceive it? How does it operate? And so I think the Supreme Court does need to wrestle with that question. And I hope what we see is an answer that focuses more on the ways in which government is restricting religious exercise And not only on whether you made exceptions for other people, although again, that is still very helpful to religious claimants.
Thank you, Lori. The next question I think we'll direct to anyone who would like to take it on. I would like to ask the attorneys where they see Bostick and its progeny in legislation taking this debate. Another Supreme Court case that we've all grappled with recently. Professor Garnett, I imagine you've done some thinking about this. Would you like to field this question?
Sure, I'll try to start. If you recall, Judge, at the end of my remarks, you asked me what we might be looking for going forward. And I suggested that it strikes me that a number of religious freedom controversies are going to grow out of this tension between some anti-discrimination requirements on the one hand and religious objections on the other. Bostick, you know, to put it bluntly, has dramatically increased the potential for such conflicts. In the Bostock case, the Supreme Court did what many people have been asking Congress to do for a long time, and which Congress has not done. and so by interpreting federal law in such a way that the term sex and the prohibition on sex discrimination in Title VII also applies to claims of gender identity discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination. It's just a fact in today's world that that's an arena where traditional religious believers have deeply held commitments about what marriage is, what human nature is, and so on. They're going to come in conflict with the court's interpretation of Bostock. And I think the administration is going to do what it can to take the interpretation of sex that's in Bostock and insert that into other federal statutes, Title IX, for example, and into its contracting policies and so on. So Bostock is extreme, although it's not strictly speaking a religious freedom case, and although I think Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the opinion, is quite committed to religious freedom as he understands it, there's no doubt that Bostock is going to create a number of conflicts, especially, frankly, if Congress does not enact the Equality Act. If Congress enacts the Equality Act, then Bostock doesn't matter all that much anymore. But if Congress doesn't, then Bostock's impact on the religious freedom debate will be quite significant.
Lori, could you tell us a little bit about the way Bostock has impacted your work?
It's been really interesting to see, as Professor Garnett said, there's, you know, a line in Bostock talking about free exercise being at the heart of our pluralistic society. And so I think it's pretty clear the court has signaled that there's more to be said about this issue, and they have not fully cashed all that out. The question in Bostock was Title VII and what sex means in Title VII, how that's applied. But the issue is now what we're seeing from courts and from the administration is, okay, well, Title IX also talks about sex. Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act also talk about sex. And so now we're seeing the government applying this definition of sex in these other contexts as well that were not addressed by the Bostock decision. And so you do have questions, as Professor Garnett alluded to, about colleges and universities and what that means for their obligations under Title IX. You have questions for healthcare providers who are faced with issues regarding treatment for those with gender dysphoria and seeking gender transitions, about what sort of treatment they are obligated to provide and what sort of steps they are obligated to take under the law. And so I think that we're going to see a number of conflicts in the wake of Bostock that are not just about Title VII and what was decided there, but about all these other statutes that also speak to sex discrimination.
Lori, if I remember correctly, the United States of America in the last administration did a really nice job of briefing that precise issue, the potential reach of Bostock if it was decided the way that ultimately the Supreme Court did. So if anybody's looking for something on that issue, the potential full impact given the federal statutes that exist, the United States did a nice job of briefing it. We'll move to our next question, a good textualist question. If you look at the First Amendment, the text says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. To the questioner, this seems pretty clear that religious conduct and belief is protected textually, regardless of what prior courts have said. But isn't the real textual question how you define religion? Any thoughts on that? Professor Garnett, we'll go to you first.
Sure, I'll try, although I suspect Professor Cooper knows the founding era discussion of this better than I do. So the questioner is certainly right about the text, and the text requires us to think about what counts as religion. I mean, again, as I said in my kind of setting up remarks, the text of the Constitution has a prohibition directed at Congress. Now it's directed against all governments. We can put that aside for now. Against interfering with a particular thing, and that particular thing is the free exercise of religion. So we can't avoid wrestling with the question, what counts as religion and what counts as the free exercise of religion? And so that's why I raised the question of, belief and conduct. It would have been easy for the drafters of the Constitution to say, anyone may believe what they want to about God. They didn't say that. They said more than that, right? At the same time, as Professor Cooper discussed, it seems pretty clear that the founding generation understood free exercise of religion in conjunction with a set of views about what governments were entitled to do and what citizens are obligated to do in terms of their behavior. So I don't think, I don't think it's a question, although I have great respect for those who closely emphasize the importance of constitutional text. The text doesn't answer a lot of these questions because the free exercise of religion as a term, it's kind of a term of art that we have to wrestle with and figure out what did free exercise mean? It didn't mean you can do whatever you want just because you're religious. But clearly it meant also more than just belief. And so figuring out that kind of Goldilocks spot, what is the free exercise of religion? That's the challenge. And that's where I think precedent is important and helpful because precedent gives us some data points about how in our tradition we've tried to answer this question.
Professor Cooper, would you like to approach that from a historical or academic perspective?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think there's two horns to this dilemma conceptually and constitutionally. The court in United States v. Seeger, which was a statutory case, had to consider whether or not a conscientious objector, I don't know if that was Vietnam, I think it may have been Vietnam, to military service who had sincere pacifist views but didn't believe in a supreme being, if that counted as the kind of religious objection that would be whether qualified. And the court said, yes, basically they defined religion in that case as a sincere conviction that would have a functional equivalence and somebody who did believe in a supreme being. Another way of thinking about that definition of religion, you could think of Paul Tillich, one of the great 20th century theologians who defined faith as ultimate concern. It's that which in your life sets your highest ideals. What is it that you place your end in? That's very inclusivistic. And it would raise a serious establishment clause issues. This is the dilemma, because what law would you pass could not be thought of as advancing religion if you define religion so broadly as it's any sincerely held belief? On the other hand, if you define religion in a more exclusionary way, like I suggested Madison does, the duty we owe to our creator in the manner of discharging it, that's monotheistic. First off, so what about Theravada Buddhism? What about polytheistic faith? What about Hinduism? Were those not truly religions? So the challenge, if you define it that way, is are you going to be broad enough to accommodate the kind of religious pluralism you might want to accommodate? Either way you go, there's a price to be paid, it seems to me, conceptually. And so, yeah, it's something, I kind of like what Professor Garnett said, it's a bit of a term of art. You do have to wrestle with it, and you have to at least be honest about the kinds of the kinds of issues that the way you define religion, the kinds of questions it raises, or the implications it has. So anyway, that's my shot at that.
I'm sorry, and I can't type into the Q&A, but I do have a follow-up question, if that's all right. And it's this, you know, there has been a group calling itself the Church of Satan, which I don't think is actually a theistic group or whatever, but they've been very provocative and really kind of clever in that they've brought legal challenges. I think arguing, for example, that certain kinds of restrictions on abortion challenge their sincere religious beliefs. So, you know, what is done with a group like that?
Well, I'm happy to start, although I think Lori's actually been involved in some of these cases. But, you know, my own view is that the Church of Satan cases that you mentioned, Alan, and there's been, you know, think of who's the late night guy, John Oliver did something like this, tried to set up a church to sort of poke fun at tax exempt status for churches. There's been things involving the so-called Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster and so on. In prison cases, courts often have to wrestle with what might appear to be kind of, let's say, esoteric claims of religious affiliation. Courts have been willing to go back to my kind of six questions that regimes have to answer, have been willing to get into the sincerity of claimants' beliefs. And one can find a lot of cases where courts have said, look, we think you're just trolling us. You don't really have a religious exemption. Professor Cooper mentioned the draft cases where the court adopted, in a statutory interpretation case, a very broad understanding of what counts as a religion. And that's certainly true. But I think there's been a little bit of a retreat from that. I mean, in the Yoder case about the Amish, the Supreme Court made it pretty clear that religion means religion. It doesn't mean like Thoreau walking in the woods and communing with the wind or anything like that. Another strategy that courts have used, and again, I'm sure Lori's seen this because she's in the trenches, is courts will just assume for the sake of argument that a religious claim is religious, and then they'll just use one of the other variables that's involved in the doctrine to dispose of the case. So again, in a lot of these prison cases, the court will assume for the sake of argument that a prisoner who says that, you know, he worships a Norse god that requires him to be able to carry a hammer around the jail cell, they'll assume it's a religious claim, but the claimant will lose anyway on the balancing of interest tests. And you know, that might well be a smart strategy by courts because they don't want to get into theological questions to the extent they can avoid them.
Lori, would you be able to share with us a little bit about your experience with these types of organizations?
Certainly, and we've had people involved with these organizations. One interesting case was we represented the city of Pensacola. They had a cross in one of their public parks that had been erected originally on the eve of World War II by a private organization and left there. And it was used for memorial services and private groups reserving it for Easter services and things over the years. And it was actually somebody who was with I don't know if he was officially with Church of Satan, but he wanted to reserve it. He was an atheist who'd sued over the cross and then reserved it on Easter Sunday for his own rituals and prevented the church from being able to use it. You know, what we've seen in these cases again and again is that you have claims that are not really religious in nature. They are a critique of religion. They are an attempt to make fun of religious people and to try and get a perceived benefit by using some religious language or exemption that's in the law. And so I think that many of these claims really do come down to a kind of sincerity analysis, as well as this question about what is a religion? And simply existing to make fun of organized religion is not in itself a religion. You need something more than that. And I think that's where these claims really do fall apart. They do a good job of making religious people uncomfortable, you know, and getting their names in the headlines, but they do a really bad job of making serious legal claims that would really stand up.
Thank you. We've got one last question. I think we might have just enough time to finish it out. In some cases, the religious expression, which can be regulated by the government, are clear. For example, the government could constitutionally bar human sacrifices. We've seen cases like that. Others are more difficult. One example may be the use of substances during worship, which is Employment Division versus Smith. Where do the panelists see this line? We'll narrow the question a little bit. See this line right now. Cody, would you mind if we start with you?
Well, I mean, the Fulton case is going to be a test of this, of how far can you extend the idea of what counts as religious expression? Carrying out, you know, what you believe to be a duty in the civil sphere, in the public square, in civil society, of engaging in foster care services, and for some religions, it's a hard question, because some religions you see that have a plenary understanding of human action as under, they can color it as, you know, a lot of behavior as doing a religious duty or doing or carrying out religious conviction. So, I mean, I agree with the questioner. I think is pointing to something that's very difficult, and I think it does require judgment. And I'm not sure what more to say about it, except that where the court is right now, I think we'll get a clue of how far they're willing to extend that in this case.
Professor Garnett, would you like to read tea leaves for us?
Yeah, the questioner asked about a line, and I suppose I don't think there is one. These doctrines, the relevant doctrines in the accommodations context, the relevant rules, whether you call it strict scrutiny or something else, they call for a balance. I would say this, though. I think this is really important. Sometimes in the religious freedom context, people who are skeptical of religious claims will say something like, look, sure, I'm for religious liberty, so long as it doesn't interfere with what the government wants to do. So on that view, religious liberty is kind of what's left over after the government does what it wants to do. And that's wrong, in my view. The very nature of, and we can argue about what free exercise of religion means, but it means something more than whatever's left over. It means more than the scraps. So any meaningful interpretation of the First Amendment and any meaningful commitment to religious freedom means that sometimes, because religious freedom really is a foundational commitment of our entire constitutional experiment, it's not what's left over, it's like the foundation. That means sometimes the government doesn't get to do what it wants to do. And I think if there's anything that I could, that I try to leave people with when we're talking about this topic, is to resist the religious freedom as leftovers theory. It doesn't mean religious claimants always win. They don't, right? If you want a human sacrifice, you lose. But it does mean that, again, religious freedom is not sort of what the government decides to let you do because it doesn't really care what you're doing. Sometimes it puts real demands on the political majority to respect the religious commitments of perhaps an irritating minority.
Lori, would you like to comment on that line or give us some parting thoughts on our first freedom?
I think that's, really, really beautifully said by Professors Cooper and Garnett. I think that, it's really important to remember, I think, that exemptions in some cases should be judicially available. I think it's better both practically and historically and textually as the way to do it. But I think it is important to remember that is not our only source of line drawing, and there is real benefit to us as a civil society. And our elected representatives coming together to work these things out and determine where they are going to legislate and regulate and where they're not going to legislate and regulate, where they're going to leave space, not because the leftovers is all you get, but because that's actually part of the hard work that we have to do as a society, is figure out how a nation of diverse believers is going to live together. And it's important to remember that that's where we come from. You look at the religious wars that were going on in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries, And there was real fear on the part of our founders of what a religious minority might do to another, what a religious majority might do to another. This is a framework for us to live together as a diverse people and live under one government. And I think both the legislatures and the courts and even the executive branch ought to have a role to play in that.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Cody. Thank you, Rick. We appreciate the fact that we were able to get you here with us today via Zoom. I'm confident that our next meeting will be in person, but I'm so glad that we were able to have you all here today. Alan, I'm going to turn this back over to you.
Thanks, Your Honor. Yes, I would. We would very much like to thank our participants. It's really been an edifying discussion, and we're very fortunate. I guess perhaps one, you know, silver lining of the Zoom era is that it makes it easier to do this sort of thing, even though we're geographically remote. So thank you all again, and thanks everyone for attending. And with respect to the CLE, we will be submitting it. But in any case, if there's any hiccup or snafu, we have your contact information. We will contact you. But assume that it will be submitted, and that'll be fine. So thanks again for attending, and we look forward to the next event.